I'm here with Dr. Stephen Nooks, a senior lecturer, not senior lecturer.
Yet.
Okay.
Soon
to be senior lecturer on Chinese politics at the University of Auckland. And we're here today to talk about China and the environment, which is quite interesting, especially given Trump's recent speech at the UN and stepping down from the Paris Agreement. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Let's maybe start with a bit of background on Chinese foreign policy, which is something that you lecture in at the university. Can you give me just a quick overview of what that looks like?
Well, the Chinese foreign policy around the world is premised on a couple of central principles. Non-conditionality and non-intervention in the politics of states with which China has relations. Mostly that is a function of China's own national psyche and the experience of quasi-colonialism that began in China in the 18th century and didn't really abate until midway through the 20th.
So 1949 with the establishment of the CCP and all of that going forward.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, during the early decades of communist rule in China, much of Chinese foreign policy was determined internationally by socialist ideology. And it was other countries of that political bent with which China initially had most of its contact. That sort of fell away by the 1970s as China became more pragmatic about the kinds of diplomatic relationships it had around the world and opened up ties with the United States.
And now we're in a position where China has influence all over the world and is almost, but not quite, another superpower to kind of rival the US's hegemony.
China is now the world's second largest economy. Not necessarily on an individual household purchasing power scale, but by volume overall. And it is the world's largest emitter of carbon outputs. Still a well-known human rights violator, and is home to roughly a fifth of all of humanity and more than half of everyone in the world living in a non-democracy.
Well, that's pretty overwhelming stats because that makes them very influential. And talking about their rise to power, they obviously need energy to fuel that industrial growth. And this has influenced some of the foreign policy initiatives that they've taken, especially in places like Africa.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, China traditionally has been heavily reliant on coal because it's what China's own domestic conditions actually support. It's what China has the most of. And that has carried with it the effects that are now clearly visible in China's own environment, but also pushed China in more recent times towards being an energy leader in other fields. China has been much quicker to embrace solar technology, for example, than the United States has been.
And how are they going on that development front? I mean, China is a place that could really turn around huge energy resources if it really invested in these types of things. And it is becoming one of those leaders in terms of diplomacy. But how is it going actually when we look at their energy uses and resources?
To be honest with you, I'm not exactly certain what precise components of the Chinese energy market are made up by which type of energy. I don't have the latest facts and figures on that. I can simply say that China has invested in alternative energies in ways that other traditional leading economic powers have not. The United States has been quite slow on the uptake relative to China.
Especially since the election of Trump as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's likely to remain the case for the foreseeable future. The U.S. is likely as anything to divest from some of those alternative energy sources. All the while, China is picking up steam, both economically and environmentally, by proving itself to be a global leader in these areas.
And now, going over to maybe some of the more of the polar issues, and I mean polar isn't like Antarctic and Arctic, China has been growing their presence there scientifically and investing in building infrastructure down there for some time now. What do you think some of the goals there could be? I mean, is it just to step up into that vacuum that the US is leaving by Trump stepping down from taking that role as the kind of funder of research in the area? Or could there be alternative goals there? Or what's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm far from an expert, but I would just say that I think yes to all of the above. There's a number of overlapping drivers behind this, one of which would be a genuine desire on China's part to play a stronger role in scientific enterprise. Another might be drive for resources of one sort or another. Partly, I imagine much of the motivation is also about prestige. And this is intimately tied to scientific advance and technological advance, that there is prestige and reputational gains to be had by playing a greater part in these processes.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I was just having a discussion earlier with someone about the move from universities being focused on knowledge for knowledge's sake to being more economically based, whereas being in a position to just focus on knowledge for knowledge's sake is a privilege. And I guess China is making a move to kind of, now that they've got this huge economic standing behind them, they can really make those moves to do that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, knowledge for the sake of economic advance is a great thing, but knowledge for knowledge's sake is valuable too. And China is in a position that it never has been before to really make investments in this field as well.
We were discussing earlier the idea of south-to-south relations. You know, we spoke earlier about China being a quasi-colonialized state, and they have therefore sympathy for other states that have been like that, like, for example, in Africa. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
The basic idea is that one former colonial country is more easily able to identify with other former colonial countries, and therefore that any aid that comes from that former colonial country or flows from one former colony to another is viewed through a slightly different lens, one that is non-exploitive, one that is more symmetrical. As China's own government would put it, the relationship is one of win-win. I personally think we need to be a little bit healthily skeptical of that. It's pretty rare in international politics that everyone wins equally.
Yeah.
It's much more common that there are winners and there are losers. Nevertheless, the idea is that China can and will understand the needs of other countries in the global south in ways that countries from the global north, which have historically been colonizers, can't and won't and don't.
What I found really interesting about our discussion earlier was that you mentioned that they, unlike the North, like EU institutions and US institutions, which put a whole lot of conditions and interest on these loans and say, oh, you have to be democratic and put Western ideals into the funding and aid money. China doesn't do that. Like you said before, they have these non-conditionality, non-interference principles.
Yeah, I mean, I always understand this as China doing unto others as they would have others do unto them, just as China abhors, as they would put it, arrogant foreigners dictating to them on matters of domestic policy. They are extremely reticent to do that in other countries with which they have these kinds of relationships across the global south. China will ask no awkward questions. Domestic political problems are domestic political problems and therefore are none of the aid provider's business.
So going forward into the future, last question before we wrap it up, what can you see for China and its relationship to the environment, climate change, and energy?
I think what you're going to see is China, because it's able to do so and willing to do so, making much larger investments in green technology and really cementing its position as a global leader in this area. The United States, for any number of overlapping reasons, is simply not willing or not able to make these similar kinds of investments. And the state-dominated model of development that exists in China facilitates a sort of green rise that is really unthinkable in many other parts of the world.
Especially with market-led economies, which need that kind of capital investment from the first part. With China, you've got state-led initiatives and policy that back it up and can enforce it, right?
So yeah,
that
means- I mean, in many ways, economic and environmental detriment is a politicized issue in China, often in ways that people in the Western world don't see or don't understand. I couldn't really sit here and say nobody is concerned about the politics of the environment in China. That's patently false. But the institutional and legal landscape of China make reinvestment in environmental cleanup, in green technologies, in alternative energies of whatever source, a thing that's much closer to reality than is possible in the US.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, for coming up today.
Thanks very much for having me.